All right, good day, everyone. I want to welcome everyone again to the History of Zionism, Part 4, and thank Becky and Avi Katz for their sponsorship this year. Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Reb Aryeh Leib, his neshama should have an aliyah. Part 4 is facts on the ground. And by 1881, it's safe to say that the Zionist movement, as yet unnamed, but whose fundamental idea was extant in the Jewish world, was floundering. Extant is not to say that it was popular or perceived as practical or even imminent, because it wasn't. For some, the Zionist objective was unwanted, as their path to paradise in this world was through socialism and universalism, not a parochial Jewish homeland. And for others, it was impractical, as the stuff of dreamers, what Chazal called Hilchata de Meshicha, something that is for the Messianic era, that could await, is even a harbinger of Messianic times. For a small group of Kalischer and others, it was a religious, political, and national imperative that should not await the Mashiach. And they already had some modest achievements that we discussed. Petach Tikva, Mikveh Yisrael, Zichron Yaakov, Rosh Pina. And even, it's not their achievement, but even in the 1860s, 1870s, you had an influx of Hungarian Jews and others who joined the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim, swelling their numbers and already making Jews a majority in that holy city. They weren't Zionists, to say the least, but nonetheless, they were part of the population and fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What was missing was a catalyst, and that came in 1881. We all know that the Jews long suffered under the Tsars. Or anyone who's seen Fiddler on the Roof knows that. But they suffered in a way that does not lend itself really to a musical. There was, in the 19th century, there were restrictions on movements. The original one created the Pale of Settlement at the end of the 18th century. There were bans on Jewish residents in major cities such as Moscow and the Russian capital, St. Petersburg, and only Jews who brought some benefit to the Tsar or the society, like doctors or wealthy businessmen, they received permits to live there. There were limitations on what occupations Jews could practice. There was a quota on how many Jews could attend university, even if they wanted to. And of course, there was dire, backbreaking, spirit-crushing poverty, relieved only by the grandeur of Jewish life. Every Shabbat, every Jew was a king and a queen. But then come Motzei Shabbat, and during the week, most Jews struggle to get by. And perhaps worst of all in this era, the mid-19th century, were the Cantonist regulations in which young children were seized by the Tsar's army, sometimes children as young as 8 or 9, and conscripted for service of 25 years or longer. So these children were often kidnapped from their homes, usually one per family, and they endured forced conversions, indoctrinations, maltreatment, and spiritual deprivation. Many died. It's an incredible tribute, almost a miracle, that so many remained faithful and returned to the Jewish community decades later, almost middle-aged, usually completely ignorant of Jewish life, but with a tremendous self-sacrifice. Families would change the names of their children to make it seem as if each child was an only child and not be subject to this degree. That's why you have families you had in the 19th century, families of children, each child had a different last name. Others took to blowing off their trigger fingers. And maybe the most ignoble aspect of the whole enterprise is that Jews turned on each other. Wealthy families could buy their way out and protect their children. The Jewish community had what they call choppers, who would come and literally they would chop the children of the poor to make up the quota. It was a terrible disgrace. It was divisive and unsettling and unethical. Rabbanim could do little about it. And it was one of the inspirations for Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's Musar movement. So it was the Tsar's brutality and overt Jew hatred that induced many Jews, for the first time in Jewish history, to join a revolutionary movement to overthrow the host government. Until that time, Jews had been remarkably loyal, and in every society, even rose to prominence across the Middle East, North Africa, Iberia, Europe. They became royal advisors because the kings and the dukes knew that Jews would not rebel. And why would they? Israel was home, not the Galut, so they had no interest in taking over a government. Now Jews, towards the end of the 19th century, became socialists, later communists, anti-Tsar activists, and this traversed all strata of Jews, from the yeshivot to simple Jews, from the observant to the secular. One of the cruelest czars, and the competition was fierce, was Nicholas I, who enacted the Cantonist decrees and a host of other anti-Jewish legislation, including a ban on wearing Jewish clothing, a ban on sporting long beards. Offenders would be arrested. In the 1840s, he decided to civilize the Jews by insisting they receive a Russian education with a reduced study of Torah, and enlisted the help of a maskil named Max Lilienthal. So Lilienthal traveled through Russia trying to convince the Rabbanim to consent, but he met a stone wall, and eventually he despaired and left for America. It wouldn't be the last time, though, the Russian authorities would clamp down on Torah study, which they felt rendered the Jews useless and unproductive. When Nicholas died in 1855, there was great relief, first because he was gone, and second because his son and successor, Alexander II, was deemed to be more liberal. And in fact, it was so for a time. Alexander II freed the serfs. He abandoned the Cantonist decrees. He unofficially relaxed restrictions on Jewish residence, movement, and commerce. By the way, he also sold Alaska to the U.S. in 1867. Some Jews became wealthy in this era. There were bankers, builders. Jews built the Tsar's railroads and became prosperous as a result. Jews were even permitted to buy land. So in that sense, it was a golden era. But his liberal phase ended after an assassination attempt in 1863. Jews were uninvolved, but they bore the brunt of the repression. After a decade, Alexander relaxed again. In other words, the laws, the anti-Jewish laws, were still on the books, but they were not being enforced. And then came the spark. On March 13th, 1881, Alexander II was assassinated in St. Petersburg by members of a Russian revolutionary group, the Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will, a radical group. A bomb was tossed under his bulletproof carriage. He survived, and foolishly, his security team ushered him outside his carriage, and then someone else threw another bomb at his feet, and he was killed. The bitter irony was that at the time he was moving even closer to more reforms. But with his death, his son Alexander III abandoned all reform and he became even more repressive. Jews again had nothing to do with his death, but they were convenient scapegoats. Rather than blame their fellow Russians, the government blamed the Jews. And in April 1881, violent pogroms erupted, such as never seen before in Russia. There had been pogroms in Odessa a decade earlier, but nothing compared to this. It was so brutal, so intense, that is when the word pogrom entered the lexicon in 1882. Pogrom is Russian for to destroy. And the pogroms spread over to over 100 cities and were most fierce in March and April of 1881, but they continued for several years. Jews were murdered by the hundreds, injured by the thousands, their property plundered, their women assaulted. Now, the pogromists were peasants, sometimes aided by the police, sometimes just ignored by the police, but the pogromists were also revolutionaries who perceived the Jews as too pro-Tsar, meaning they were Russian nationalists, and therefore their enemies. So it turns out that Jews during these pogroms were being attacked by pro-Tsar forces and by anti-Tsar forces. That means everybody. It's an inescapable double whammy. New repressive laws were introduced in May 1882, called the May Laws. Jews were again restricted to the Pale of Settlement. Again, they couldn't buy land. They couldn't even work on Sundays, which means, as we know, you can't work Shabbos, you can't work Sunday, you're working half a day Friday. It makes it even more difficult to earn a living. They paid steep and special taxes just on Jews. There was a separate book of laws that pertained only to Jews, and it was published. By 1914, that book contained almost 1,000 pages, just special laws for Jews. The Supreme Prosecutor of Russia, Konstantin Pobedonostsev, infamously said that the solution to the Jewish problem in Russia was, I quote, "one-third will die, one-third will emigrate, and one-third assimilate," meaning convert to Russian Orthodoxy. He was a very interesting Jew hater. Unlike many of his peers who felt that Jews were inferior, Pobedonostsev felt that Jews were, in fact, more talented than the Russians, and if they would not be suppressed, they would come to dominate Russia. So these pogroms lasted 3 years, but they were a watershed in Jewish history. This began the Great Migration. In the next 35 years, more than 2.5 million Jews would leave Eastern Europe. 2 million for America, beginning in substance the Jewish era in America. Others going to South Africa, going to Britain, going to Western Europe. At first, an average of 50,000 Jews per year left Russia. By the 1890s, it exceeded 100,000 Jews annually and peaked at more than 200,000 Jews after the pogroms of 1905. It was this period of time in Russia and of increased immigration to America that induced Emma Lazarus to write The New Colossus in 1883, her special poem that adorns the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. She didn't have to say wretched refuse, but nonetheless. She also wrote in 1882 the Epistle to the Jews, in which she too called for the revival of Jewish life in Israel. Something else happened. The Maskilim, many of whom were Russian, if not most, despaired of emancipation, of human rights, or anything constructive ever emerging from Russia. They realized that even assimilation wouldn't achieve anything, although many became even more anti-religious. Some of them became revolutionaries, as did other Jews, socialists and communists, and some of them became Zionists. So 1881 was a real catalyst. A new era dawned when people realized there was no hope in the exile, and Jewish life would only prosper and be secure in a land where Jews would be the majority. Of all these emigrants who left Russia and Eastern Europe, about 2-3%, a very small percentage, would come to the land of Israel. But they would eventually make a profound difference in Jewish history. So, for example, the 1881 pogroms turned Peretz Smolensky into a Zionist, him we discussed last time. But it also induced Leon Pinsker in 1882 to write a pamphlet that he called Auto-Emancipation, which is essentially a primer on how to establish a Jewish homeland, and a call to arms. Yehuda Leipinsker, Leo Pinsker, a very famous street name in Israel, Rehov Pinsker, was born in Tamashov in 1821, and he really lived the struggles of Jewry in the 19th century. He was a maskil, he was a believer in emancipation, who thought the ideal way for Jews to overcome their hardships in Russia was through cultural assimilation. So he attended university in Odessa, which was Haskalah's stronghold. He studied law, and then he gave it up because of the quotas on Jewish lawyers, and he became a physician. I guess he thought it was preferable to be an attorney than a physician. Nothing personal. But the Odessa pogroms in the 1870s, Odessa's a very progressive city, disabused him of assimilation and led him to publish a magazine that he called Tzion, with the aim of fostering a Jewish national spirit. The true Jew, he said, was the one who remained attached to his past and his people. And again, bear in mind, he wasn't an all-observant. And then the pogroms began in 1881, led him to despair of anything positive emerging for Jews in Europe. Pinsker traveled through Western Europe, and then he despaired even more as he, like others before him, found Jews less than interested in the idea of a Jewish national home. To some it was unnecessary, to others it was preposterous. And that first led him to write Auto-Emancipation. Only if we help ourselves is there any hope of success. Emancipation was a gift of the nations, the host country. Auto-emancipation was the only way for Jews to finally rid themselves of a state of dependency and weakness. He wrote, I quote, in English translation, "No matter how much the nations are at variance with each other, however diverse their instincts and aims, they join hands in their hatred of the Jews. On this matter, they're all agreed. In the great majority of cases, the Jew is treated as a stepchild. In the most favorable cases," he meant Western Europe, "as an adopted child. Never is he considered a legitimate child of the fatherland." And he didn't mince words at all, writing to recalcitrant Jews who thought Jew hatred was a phase, that it would wither and die in the modern world. He said to them, "You are contemptible because you have no real self-estimation," meaning self-esteem, "and no national self-respect." And he labeled the thought that Jews would be respected for their patriotic contributions to even more democratic countries an idle delusion. He said, "There's something unnatural about a people without a territory, just as there is about a man without a shadow." Pinsker dismissed the term anti-Semitism, which had just been invented a few years earlier to put a sophisticated veneer on adulterated Jew hatred, and he, Pinsker, called it Judeophobia, and he said it's a psychic aberration that is unfortunately hereditary. And as a former physician, he said, "As a disease transmitted for 2,000 years, it is incurable." So Pinsker called for the renaissance of a Jewish national home, but he was not committed to Israel, to the land of Israel. He wrote, "If so, all the better. But first, Jews should ascertain what countries and lands are available to them." And he ended, "Help ourselves, and God will help you." That Auto-Emancipation became the controversial sensation that, for example, Moses Hess's on Roman Jerusalem was not 20 years earlier is attributable almost entirely to the period of time in which it was published, during the pogroms. So Pinsker attracted some support, but he also attracted much antagonism. He wrote in German, but he didn't limit himself to writing. He became obsessed with the idea, and he became one of the founders of a movement, Chibat Zion, whose members were Chovevei Zion, lovers of Zion. which was officially founded in 1884, although its roots were in a conference held in Focșani, Romania in early 1882. And it's very well known, Chibat Zion, the organization, for all the glamour and mystique history attached to it, was almost doomed from the start. Its leaders were a very motley group. Pinsker, who was raised secular, Moshe Leib Lilienblum, no relation to the other Lilienblum, who was born outside of Kovno, who was raised religious and became bitterly anti-religious, and Rav Shmuel Moaliver, who was a Talmud of Volozhin and the Rav of Bialystok. So Chovei Tzion had its formal founding conference in Katowice in 1884, but they had already done some legwork, meaning its accomplishments preceded its founding, unusual for a Jewish organization. With the support of Baron Edmund de Rothschild in 1882, already 10 Chovei Tzion pioneers founded the new town of Rishon LeZion, named because it was literally Rishon LeZion. They broke ground for the great synagogue in 1885, it still stands. The winery was established in 1886. In Rishon, they even created the blue and white flag that would become the symbol of the Zionist movement and the flag of Israel. Naftali Herz Inber, the composer of Hatikva, or Tikvatenu as he called it, even lived there himself in the early 1880s, although the poem he wrote in 1877. The Chovei Tzion attracted support from rabbis like the Netziv and secular Jews as well, but the leaders of the group, the three, were never in sync, as could be imagined. Rav Moaliver as president and Rav of Bialystok convinced the Jews, some Jews of Bialystok, to move to the struggling Petah Tikva. And with Rothschild's help, he stabilized that town, which had been found in the 1870s, but was on the verge of collapse. Here, Rav Moaliver also founded the town of Ekron, today it's called Mazkeret Batya. But the difference in ideology in Chibat Zion of the leaders hampered joint projects. So Rav Moaliver eventually spun off a new movement that he called Mizrahi, which, as you know, is still around today. Mizrahi is short for Merkaz Ruchani, spiritual center. And while Pinsker saw, while Rav Moaliver saw Israel as the place of rebirth of the Jewish spirit and soul, Pinsker, the chairman, was more concerned with the Jewish body. Yet Rav Moaliver remained part of the movement, and he fought to have the others respect the rights and interests of religious Jews. But already that dichotomy developed, and there were separate organizations, and as was true for the next century and a half, religious Jews were always in the position of asking for things, asking for accommodations, rather than being leaders. The kibbutz Gan Shmuel is named for Rav Shmuel Moaliver. Meanwhile, at the same time the pogroms had started and Chibat Zion was being discussed, a secular group founded in 1881 called Bilu, an acronym for Beit Yaakov L'chuvin Elcha, based on the pasuk in Yeshayo, the house of Jacob, let us get up and go, of course pointedly omitting the last two words of the pasuk, Beit Yaakov L'chuvin Elcha, Be'or Hashem, by the light of God. They had no interest in the light of God. By the way, a similar thing happened in the Soviet Jewry movement. It's in this week's Edra. The motto was Shalach Ami, let my people go. And they left out the last word, V'ya'avduni, so they should serve me, God. So Bilu joined forces with Chovei Tzion, not just in Rishon, but also in founding Gedera as well. And this was the vaunted first Aliyah that brought 25,000 Jews to Israel from 1881 to 1903. But again, if you think of the several million Jews leaving Russia, a very, very low percentage came to Israel. Something else happened in 1881 that would make a remarkable difference in Jewish life, in the Zionist movement. Eliezer Perelman made Aliyah with his family. Who's he? better known to us as Eliezer ben Yehuda. So he was born in 1858, same year as Reb Chaim Brisker was born. Eliezer was ben Yehuda was born in Luzhsky in Lithuania into a Hasidic family. So his father died when he was but 5 years old. His mother sent him to Cheder, and then he attended yeshiva in Plotsk until age 15. But he was influenced by the Haskal and other things. Already in his late teens, he became bitterly anti-religious, and he focused much of his ire on the Yiddish language. At age 21, he Hebraicized his name. His father was Yehuda, Eliezer ben Yehuda. And then after making Aliyah in 1881, and living at first in Rishon, it dawned on him that the Jewish national renaissance would only come to fruition if Jews united around their common language, which was Hebrew. And he became Mishugah L'davar. He was obsessed. He and his wife spoke only Hebrew to each other and to their children, making them the only people in their whole town who spoke Hebrew. He wrote, "Let us revive the nation, and its tongue shall be revived as well." So keep in mind, Hess and Pinsker wrote their proto-Zionist works in German, which was the urbane language of the day. And even Herzl, we'll see next time, even Herzl assumed that German would be the language of the Jewish state. How ironic that is. But Ben Yehuda wrote that our youth is abandoning its language because in their eyes it is a dead and useless language. End quote. He became known as the Mechayev, the reviver of the Hebrew language. In truth, it bears mention that this is both a misnomer and an overstatement. So Hebrew was not dead at all. Maybe it was dead to Ben Yehuda. But keep in mind the obvious point that we all know. Hebrew was the language of davening. It was the language of Tanakh, of Svarim. While Ben Yehuda was saying Hebrew is dead, Rav Yisrael Salanter was writing his books in Hebrew, as did the Chafetz Chaim, as the Rosh Hashulchan, as did all the Sheilot u'Tshuvot of the 19th century, all while Ben Yehuda was claiming it was dead. It wasn't dead, it was sacred, and it was used for sacred purposes. There was no educated Jew who didn't know Hebrew. It was Ben Yehuda, though, who made it into an everyday language. That was his objective, and to that end, he produced, years later, 1908, a Hebrew dictionary of 5 volumes that contained not only a dictionary, but he coined hundreds of new words, all rooted somehow in Tanakh or the Aramaic of the Talmud. Some of his new words remain, and I'll share some with you. We'll recognize them right away. And Ben Yehuda was brilliant in the sense that he created words with Torah roots for items that did not exist in biblical times. For example, glida, ice cream, was Ben Yehuda's word. Midracha, a sidewalk. The Torah says about the land of Seir, ki lo atein lachem me'atzam ad midrach kaf ragel. I won't give you even a place to set your feet, a place where your feet walk. Midrach became midracha. Rakevet, train, just an extension of rechev, a chariot. Ekdach, ki eish kadcha ba'api, shad hazinu. Ekdach is a firearm. Eish kadcha ba'api, fire came out of my nostril, etc. Some of his words didn't catch on, we can say quite fortunately. Amonut, from am, democracy. Instead, demokratia. He had a piano as a makoshit, something that you pound. Psanter sounds better. In other words, also, he also founded something that exists until today, the Vad HaLashon HaEvrit, the Committee for the Hebrew Language, which I assume is responsible for television, radio, etc., which I also assume would horrify him. To his chagrin, Yiddish has remained popular as well, as in Parv. What's the Hebrew word for Parv? Stami. Nobody uses that word. What's the Hebrew for gefilte fish? Dug mimula. Nobody uses that. Years ago, I went to a supermarket here, and I wanted to buy gefilte fish, and I asked a salesperson for dug mimula. He said, ma, dug mimula. He said, I don't know what it is. I said, gefilte fish. So he said, why didn't you say so? His children adopted the surname Ben Avi. Ben Avi sounds like the son of my father, which doesn't really add anything. But Ben Avi, Aleph Bet Yud, Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Ben Avi. Since his father was Yehuda, they didn't want to use that name. But to his credit, he did take a language that was essentially liturgical or intellectual and make it commonplace. And if you think about it, such has not happened with Latin. The church rarely uses Latin anymore today, the Catholic Church, and certainly almost nobody uses it in common speech, Akkadian, Aramaic, or other ancient tongues. He, by the way, was also the person who pioneered the use of the Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew words. That too was resisted by traditionalists who maintain, at least for davening, their Ashkenazic pronunciations. And that's a big issue in Israel. I remember even Rav Cook, father and son, I heard the son myself, davened the old Ashkenazic way, while he spoke Hebrew, at least the latter spoke Hebrew, with a Sephardic pronunciation. He didn't daven that way, though. There's another dimension of Zionism that began in the 1880s, and that was the contribution of Achad Ha'am, Asher Ginsberg. I have a grandson by that name, no relation. So Asher Ginsberg was also born into a Hasidic family. He joined Chibat Zion, but he saw a primary way in which they were lacking. And you'll notice, he tried to thread the needle in a way that still resonates in some quarters. So he was no longer religious. But in visiting Israel in the early 1890s, he felt the dearth of ruach, of spirit. He saw Israel as the national spiritual center of the Jews. But how? Without Torah? Without mitzvot? That objective then and today remains an elusive challenge. So he tried to create a way that the spirit of Israel can exist without the Torah of Israel. And he rightly felt all these little settlements dependent for their subsistence on money from the exile could not sustain itself, or could not sustain themselves, but only through reviving or creating a Jewish culture could the Jewish national project succeed. This cultural Zionism to him was more important than working for political goals. He in fact worked for the Vysotsky Tea Company, and thus he was able to travel widely and spread his ideas. It was a very odd mix. He wrote to Judah Magnus in 1910 that assimilation was a greater danger to Jews than it was Jew hatred. And he wrote, I quote, "Learning, learning, learning was the secret of Jewish survival." Well, he didn't mean Torah, or at least he didn't mean only Torah, so it's not clear what he meant. He criticized Reform for detaching the Jewish religion from Jewish nationalism, correctly predicting that such would result in the ruin of both nationalism and the religion. But he held curiously, and to some extent it's still popular today, the notion that, I quote, "it is possible to be a Jew in the national sense without accepting many things in which religion requires belief." So that could be true per se, but it's unsustainable from generation to generation, as ethnic identity and commitment tends to wane, especially when one is exposed to or intermarries with other ethnicities. He did not believe that a Jewish state would solve the Jewish problem, and he feared that founding a state before we were ready would result in what he called a state of Jews, and not a Jewish state. It's so interesting that from a totally different perspective, in the 1970s, 1980s, Rav Meir Kahane, Shem Yikom Damo, He wrote about this extensively, criticizing what he saw as a state of Jews as opposed to creating a Jewish state. But Acharam wrote, we should not be seduced by material power as long as we remain faithful to our principles as taught by the prophets. We did not lose our self-respect as a nation, even in the face of more powerful enemies. And that's what he urged on his contemporaries. He became very popular, but it's still arguable whether that needle can ever be threaded. To be Jewish without mitzvot, to have Jewish culture without God or Torah, to have Jewish values uprooted from their source. It hasn't stopped generations from trying, but Acharam remained more of a gadfly than a powerful force in the Zionist movement. Well, Chibat Zion was largely unsuccessful, if we look at it objectively. Pinsker wanted the central office to be located in Berlin, but could find no one interested or competent to run it there, so it remained in Odessa with a smaller office in Warsaw. The original conference in Katowice attracted only 40 participants, 40 people, mostly from Russia and Romania, and a handful from England and Germany. So it wasn't a mass movement. Different chapters formed in small towns, but each chapter had its own objective. By the second conference in 1887, Rav Mollever was intent on turning it into a religious movement, but the resistance was strong. The goals were similar, but the paths to achieve those goals diverged dramatically. The religious Jews and the Maskilim could not easily work together. Typical of their divergent worldviews, was the controversial observance of the first Shemitah since the dawn of this era in 1889. Pinsker cut off funding to any yeshuv that observed Shemitah. Baron Rothschild turned to the Chovetz Zion rabbis to seek a heter, fearing that letting the land lie fallow would destroy their agricultural efforts that were still in their infancy. The Netziv refused. The Netziv held, like the Rambam, that Shemitah's Daraita, even Bizman Hazeh, it's a Torah prohibition. Rav Shmuel Maliva disagreed with that, and he saw several grounds to permit a sale of the land to Arabs. It'd been done on a small scale already for several centuries, but he said it on condition that Rabbi Yitzchak Achanan Spector approved as well. And in fact, Rabbi Yitzchak Achanan was the God of Ador in Kovna. He did, with other rabbis, approve the Heta Mechira, selling the land to an Arab for the purpose of the Shemitah year. Note the irony, by the way, for those who say rabbis always have agendas in their Piskei Halacha. It was the Chovev Tzion, the Netziv, who opposed the Heta Mechira. It was the non-Chovev Tzion, so to speak, the non-Zionist Rav Yitzchak Achanan Spector who agreed to it. But on the ground in Israel, in the old Yishuv, both the venerable Rav Shmuel Salant and Rav Shua Leib Diskin opposed the Heter. The Levush Mordechai Gimbel Yaffe, was long the Rav of Ruzhinai, who made Aliyah several years before and lived in Yehud. He was a member of Chovei Tzion. He also opposed the Heter. He said he's shocked, that a return to Israel could necessitate discarding a mitzvah. Imagine coming back to Israel thousands of years and saying, okay, now we don't have to observe Shabbos, we have to work. Made no sense. A big dispute arose between Rothschild and Rav Mollever. Rothschild thought that Rav Mollever should have done more to convince people to accept the Heter. Nevertheless, by the next Shemitah, it would be 1896, right before the first Zionist Congress, it was less contentious. The old Yishuv found a way to accommodate the Heter, but on some levels, we know the dispute lives on, and we will revisit it next year, 5782, Tavshin Pei Bet, which is the Shemitah year. In any event, during those years, the Chibat Zion focused on fundraising for the settlements, but most of the money was coming from Rothschild anyway. It was a grassroots movement without much grass. And the focus on fundraising diminish the ardor for actual aliyah and settlement. For all practical purposes, they had reached a political dead end. The pogroms and the unrest in Russia had made its mark. About a third of Russian Jewry left by the time World War I started. Roughly 5.5 million still remained. But millions had left. Very few had gone to the land of Israel. A new catalyst was needed. And even more so, what was needed was a charismatic, fearless, adventurous leader who would break down doors and jumpstart the idea of the Jewish national home. That person was Binyamin Zev Herzl, Theodor Herzl, one of a kind, with one of the strangest life stories and odysseys of any Jew. In the history of Zionism, we have finally arrived at the age of Herzl, and we'll take him up next time. I thank you all very much. I hope to do it again in a couple of weeks, not a month. Thank you again.